Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games, where I interview creators about their games and inspirations, and about the theory, process and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, your host today and always, and your friendly local indie enthusiast. Today we're kicking off our spring season of RPG Latam interviews with Misha Panarin, a role-playing game creator from Argentina, as well as creating Urchins, a very cool introductory expansion for Blades in the Dark. She was also one of the five creators in the Latam Breakout project from last year, with her awesome game, Cantrip, a belonging outside belonging tribute to Little Witch Academia. Now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. So today we're talking to Misha Panarin. Hi there, Misha, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Absolutely no problem. We love having all kinds of designers from all over the world on Yes Indeed Pod, especially this season of Yes in RPG Latam. With that in mind, would you like to introduce yourself and let us know who you are in indie tabletop role-playing games?
Sure thing. My name is Misha, pronouns she, her. I'm a tabletop RPG player and designer from Argentina. I was born and raised here. And like most of my, let's say my output, my creative output in the TTRPG scene has been stuff like jam entries, small hacks and supplements. But I've been getting more and more into developing full-fledged games.
Fantastic.
My goal in general is to make the games that I would like to play and then hope that people like them as well.
That is a very noble goal, and one that I think everybody should take to heart, really, because it's better to make games for yourself than for other people, in my extremely humble opinion.
Yeah, I agree completely.
You mentioned that you had taken part in quite a lot of jams. Do you remember what your first jam was? Because I'm always really interested to know when people kind of enter jam scenes.
Yes, I do remember, actually, yeah. My first jam was, my first jam entry was for the Folklore Jam, which was a very big jam.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That was big, yeah.
It was very big, asking people to make content for Morgborg inspired by the folklore and mythology of various places in the world. It was a very well-organized jam. There was this master document where people would basically call dibs on something so that you didn't have, like, I don't know, like 10 people doing a Baba Yaga or whatever.
Yeah, super. That's really cool.
It was.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because last year I did a season on RPGC, RPGSEA, and yes, a lot of the people there were like, it was the sad mech jams.
Yeah, I don't think that there has been. So anyway, my entry for that jam was the Boitui. It's one of the seven most notorious monsters in Guarani mythology. The Guarani being an indigenous people native to what is now the northeast of Argentina, Paraguay, the south of Brazil. So the Boitui is a snake monster that has the head of a parrot.
Nice. That sounds terrifying.
It is terrifying. It lives in swamps and wetlands. My original goal was to actually do all seven of the monsters from this, this suite of monsters from that mythology, but I didn't have the time or energy to do all seven because I was just learning, on one hand, the rules of Morgborg, which, you know, they're simple. And I was also learning layout. And my very first attempt at doing a proper layout for something was emulating the Morgborg style, which is kind of difficult.
That requires a lot of patience, no doubt.
Yeah, I had to learn a lot about how I use Affinity Publisher, as a lot of us do, for layout. And it was very fun, actually. The signed document that I believe it was Johan who put it together for Morgborg is extremely good, and it was very useful.
Well, you know, I've heard a lot of people trying to emulate the Morgborg style, and bouncing off that is super difficult, but well done.
Yeah, it is both technically difficult, and also like from a design perspective, it might look like chaotic and sometimes random on the surface, but there's a lot going on to keep things legible and understandable.
I keep hearing Jeremy Gage talk to people who are trying to emulate the Merc Borg style in their zine layout and stuff, and it just sounds completely impossible to. I'm not super familiar with Merc Borg. To be honest, I sort of bounce off the visual style a little bit because it's right. Kind of, it's a bit intense for my brain, but you know, I do still have massive respect for it because people talk about it all the time. So I think it's really interesting to try and work in a style that you really respect. So yeah, kudos to you, really.
Oh, thank you.
Are there some other things that you know that people might know you for?
I think that my most successful indie release, ignoring for now Cantrip, the game that I released as part of the LATAM Breakout Kickstarter that was put together by Soul Muppet Publishing.
Yes.
Like, beyond that, my biggest indie release was a supplement for Blades in the Dark.
Oh, cool. Very much one of my favorites.
Yeah, I really love the game. I love how easy it is to make content for it.
How permissive the license is as well. It's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, it is really, really permissive. It's a very good license. The SRD is very complete, which I appreciate a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So Urchins is a new crew type that has a lot of variant rules, because something that I found when running Blades in the Dark for new people is that even though a lot of the, let's call it the bookkeeping, that right, the accounting in Blades in the Dark is offloaded onto the GM, it can still be a little overwhelming for new people because they have to learn a lot of new language for playing Blades. You know, they have to know about stress and heat and entanglements and stuff like that. I was thinking, like, what if we could make this easier? What if we could add this scaffolding gradually in a way that also makes sense within the narrative in your Blades campaign?
Yeah.
And I had just finished watching the TV show Arcane, and especially the first few episodes of Arcane, they feel a lot like a Blades in the Dark game.
Sure, yeah. I see what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, the Piltover Zone setting is very Duskfall. The crew of, you know, urchins trying to steal something and getting in over their heads is also something that I feel is very Blades.
Relatable, yeah.
So that's what I did. I made this new crew and new playbook. The crew itself is called the Urchins. The playbook is called the Stray. And they're kind of a blank slate that gets gradually added on to.
Yeah.
Instead of the claims map that you would have with any of the regular crew sheets in Blades in the Dark, you have like a map of mechanics that you unlock at your own pace. So you start just with the very basics of Blades, just the stuff that you need to be able to play, you know, dice pools and stress.
Oh, this is really cool, yeah.
So you gradually unlock the playbooks, then you unlock heat and entanglements, then you unlock other mechanics, and eventually, when you've cleared out this map, you've unlocked every single mechanic.
That's so cool.
That's when the crew essentially graduates.
Into a proper crew type.
Into a proper crew type.
Misha, that's so cool.
Oh, thank you.
One of my favorite things about Blades in the Dark is kind of like that its onboarding is so optional, but I think players still like look at that rule book and be like, oh my god, this is 200 pages of new rules, which it's not, but okay, whatever. But what you've done is you've gamified that, and that's so cool.
I've gamified that, and also my goal was to make maybe veteran players also be interested in this.
Yeah.
Because the way I feel is that when you start a new campaign of like vanilla Blades in the Dark, there's some backstory that's alluded to in the crew and the playbooks, but that's not really all that fleshed out.
Okay, so you're playing through the backstory.
Right, you're playing like a little prologue in which you establish contacts and connections and a shared history, and you do carry some of the stuff you unlock by playing the urchins and the stray into your adult playbook.
Yeah.
All the abilities you unlock are very much geared towards like taking on people larger than yourself.
Very cool.
And trying to, you know, make a name for yourself, make a nuisance of yourself. I think my favorite ability that I wrote for this supplement, you know how teenagers are terrifying? You know how teenagers will absolutely roast you and humiliate you?
Yeah, yeah, I'm familiar.
Yeah. There's this one ability that just has you unleash insults that are so scathing, so humiliating, that it just totally disarms whoever your adult opponent is.
I love it. That's so cool. Are you just because I read Blades quite recently, is that starting at like zero hold and weak as a faction, or do you
still... You essentially have like permanent zero hold.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that nobody respects you enough to actually, you know, acknowledge any turf you might have a claim to.
Oh, this is so cool. I'm really going to have to check that out. So that's called...
Urchins.
The Urchins and the Stray was the playbook.
Yeah, you would find it on Age as Urchins.
That's so cool. So the other thing that, you know, people are familiar with is RPG Latam Breakout, which was a Kickstarter campaign.
Yes.
That Soul Muppet Games sort of hosted on behalf of loads of really cool creators from across Latin America. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that campaign?
RPG Latam, for me, is something that basically came out of nowhere. I was approached by one of the designers who was already on board, Luna.
Oh yeah, Luna, cool, yeah.
The other Argentinian designer on the Latin Breakout Kickstarter, all the other three are Brazilian. As small as the indie RPG scenes are in Argentina and Brazil, they're even smaller in other countries.
Yes, so I've heard.
Even in Chile, which is usually the country that has, let's say, the most developed fandoms and subcultures for, let's say, geek stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, it's not as big or notorious as Argentina, and even less so compared to Brazil.
Completely anecdotally, because it's not like I go out of my way to explore RPG Latam. It does feel like it's very Argentinian dominated. Like, I know a lot of people from Argentina who are RPG players or designers, and far fewer from Chile and a handful from Brazil. And I think I can name one person from like all of the rest of countries in Latin America. Yeah, it's interesting to hear that the Argentinian scene is perhaps the most developed and the most cohesive. That's really interesting.
I would say that the Brazilian scene is more developed.
Do you think that's just on account of it being, you know, a significantly larger country?
It probably does have a lot to do with that, yeah. Like, if you go to the RPG Latam Discord, which is reasonably active, I would say most people who are regulars on the Discord are from Brazil, and most of them from the South.
Sorry, we were talking about RPG Latam and Latam.
Yes.
So, sidetracked, yeah.
So I was approached by Luna, who told me about this opportunity, which I jumped at immediately. So I got in touch with Zag and Matt from Soul Muppet, and I got into the project, which, you know, for anybody who isn't aware, was a Kickstarter meant to raise funds to make five games from five designers a reality.
It's kind of like what Sandy Pug Games did for RPG SEA the previous year. And then, and Zach did sort of a similar thing, which was super cool.
I was going to say, like, as some people may be aware, Kickstarter doesn't really work in most countries. Like, here from South America, we're allowed to fund and back projects, but we're not allowed to actually run any Kickstarters. Kickstarter won't let you. They will not approve your project. They will not accept your bank information unless you are from one of the like 20 countries that they allow, which is basically North America, so most of Europe, Mexico, and I think in Southeast Asia it's Singapore.
It's really bad. I think I did a list a while ago and kind of plotted it on a world map, and I'm like, I see where all these countries are. And it's awful. Like, it's genuinely awful. There's even countries within Europe which are not accepted, you know, like I have a friend in Croatia who is not eligible for using Kickstarter. It's like,
if you're like in the Balkans or Eastern Europe, you can't. Like, if you overlay the map of where you can actually run a Kickstarter, I often tweet about how every map is the same map, the infamous international community map.
I mean, I did the same thing. It was like Kickstarter backer countries and countries with a higher than average GDP, and it's like, okay, I see.
Like, it's always the same map.
And it's terrible, you know. Basically, what you're saying is that countries outside of this very, very limited band are having to rely on people elsewhere in order to get their games publicized or published, and that sucks, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just like one of the hurdles that we have to jump over to gain any kind of notoriety or even money from indie RPGs if we're in Latin America. There's a lot of barriers. That's just one of them. The other one is that in order to design games, you have to also read a lot of games, and that usually costs money. You know, there's bundles, there's community copies, whatever, but on average, you're going to have to spend money, and you're going to have to spend US dollars, which it's a nightmare to spend when, you know, you get paid in another much less valuable currency.
Yes.
Another huge barrier is also, you know, having fewer contact in general. People pay attention to, I don't know, Gen Con or whatever. Nobody pays attention to whatever cons we have here in Latin America. Like, they're not globally notorious.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get to network, to meet industry people, because there hardly are any industry people.
I mean, it is a hindrance if your audience is an international audience, but like, if your audience was, you know, a Latin American audience and you wanted to kind of make games for Spanish and Portuguese speakers in South America, like, would that be a massive hindrance to you as a designer?
No, it would be a massive hindrance because of various reasons which intersect a lot with what I've already mentioned, such as the scene here being one, much smaller, and secondly, having a lot less spending money.
Right, yes, okay.
Like, it's
I mean, it makes sense,
easier to get the bag from Americans.
That makes complete sense, really.
Yeah, it's a sad reality, but it's what we have to deal with.
So I guess one solution to this then is to have people in other countries run Kickstarter campaigns on your behalf.
That is correct, yeah.
And for you to network that way and to get yourselves out that way. So back to Latam Breakout through this extremely, really interesting but meandering conversation.
Anyway, talking about the games themselves, we all got a budget from Soulmapper to pay for editing, artists, layout, anything we needed. They already had like some editors in reserve because, you know, they have contacts, they have people they've worked with before. Yeah. So, for instance, I didn't even have to look for an editor because they already had made a contract with Pamela Punzalan, Dove Taylor on Twitter, who is just a fantastic editor. I've said this in other interviews, but Cantrip was already, in my opinion, competently written when I got it to her. But she got it from competent to genuinely excellent. And that's such a valuable thing. None of my other games have an editor.
It's something that can be difficult to get access to, I think, if you don't have the funds. Yeah, and an editor, a good editor, is such a valuable person to have on a project. I mean, I am biased because that's what I do mostly freelance. But I genuinely think that having a good editor, and I have had stuff edited by good editors, and it's just wonderful, you know. It's wonderful to take that piece of text which feels like yours, and then to get something back which feels like yours on steroids, you know, on something incredible. Yeah, I can absolutely speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, good editors will help your own voice come through on the text.
Yes, absolutely.
So much better than you could do it yourself, which sounds impossible, but they do it. They're magicians.
I completely agree.
All editors have some dark powers that they use for editing. It's fantastic. So Cantrip was, like I said before, a game that I wanted to make for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
It is a GM-less, dice-less game in the belonging, outside belonging framework.
Okay,
so,
cool.
You know, yeah. Games like Dream Apart, Dream Askew, Orbital.
Yeah.
Well, Wonder Home is a very famous one as well.
Absolutely. Sleepaway as well. You know, we've had quite a few belonging, outside belonging designers on here, and I just love these games because they're so approachable and like super fun. So tell us about what Cantrip is. What does it speak to?
It speaks to mostly my love of, let's say, this subgenre of media, which is about young witches.
Okay, yes.
Which is something that you mostly see in like anime and manga.
Yeah, yeah.
With a few like more Western productions. Like, let's say, one of the minor inspirations for Cantrip was The Owl House.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
But I guess that the main inspiration would be Little Witch Academia, which is available to stream on Netflix, I believe.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a cool little genre. I think that's really fun, you know.
I feel like it has this nice balance between cozy, low stakes, slice of life stuff that's made all the much more exciting because of the element of literal magic. But it can also deal with strong feelings or like higher stakes and danger.
Yeah.
And that's what Cantrip seeks to emulate.
Yeah.
Cantrip doesn't have like a lot of innovations in terms of like the BOB tech, but it does have a few things that I'm pretty proud of. One thing that I noticed when playing BOB games was that sometimes the action would grind to a halt whenever nobody at the table could really think of something interesting to do or something interesting that could happen.
Yeah.
There could be like this lull in the fiction.
Yeah.
And I sought to prevent that in Cantrip by having play proceed by turns. Like, you know, going clockwise around the table, like,
right.
I don't know, like, if you've played The Quiet Year, or if you've played Mobile Frame Zero Firebrands, those are also games that, you know, go by turns.
Yeah, that's a really interesting bit of tech, actually, because that, you know, it does take the pressure off those awkward silences. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you've just summarized it perfectly, but like, you're sitting around a table, and especially like newer players can sometimes feel a bit overwhelmed, especially if they're playing across a range of experience levels.
Yeah.
If you're playing against the people who have been playing role-playing games since they were like 6 years old and have been doing it a long time, and super loud and very pushy, and like if you're a newer player,
absolutely,
like, I don't really know how to jump in here, but like I think you've taken some of the sting out of that then by saying it's your turn now, you have the floor, you speak, here's the conch, and
that is correct.
Let's hear what you've got to say. Yeah, I love it. Fantastic.
Also, I think that new players sometimes, especially in games which expect more input from players than, let's say, a more traditional game,
mm-hmm.
in which you're mostly being led along a story path by the GM, I think that new players in these situations feel like they have to come up with something original and innovative and amazing. And all the players, or more experienced players, know that it doesn't matter. You're not going to come up with anything more interesting than what the entire table can do as a team.
Yeah, it's not a creativity competition.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes what people need to remember, you know, it's not a competitive game, basically.
Yeah.
You win if everyone has fun. I think it's my general description of a role-playing game.
So when it's your turn in Cantrip, you have three options. The main option, which is like the core of the BOB gameplay, is called framing a scene.
Yeah.
You describe what's going on, you describe what the stakes are and who is present, and then you play a scene, you use your moves or role-play, whatever you feel comfortable with, until the scene is resolved, or until the situation changes so much that it merits like framing a new scene. And what framing a scene also tells you to do is to set things like in the middle of the action. Don't have, you know, any lead up to the fun part. Like, start right at where it's fun.
Start in
no need to describe yourself walking towards something when you can just be there. The other two options, which are if you don't want the floor, if you don't want to frame a big scene, you can either do what's called narrating a slice of life, in which you describe a short scene that's not necessarily related to anything that's already been going on, in which you just describe your character, your young witch at magic school, doing something that she would be doing normally. Going shopping, yeah, or studying, whatever.
That's super cool. That sounds really interesting.
Thank you. Or finally, you can get a read on the academy, which if you've played The Quiet Year, it's a lot like when you ask a question in The Quiet Year.
Okay, yeah.
You proposition like a problem or a conflict or some debate or dilemma, and every player describes the opinions and the feelings of a group in the fiction.
Uh-huh.
And then whatever is decided after that is canon, is truth.
That's so cool. Three really interesting bits of tech, like one of which is strongly influenced by The Quiet Year, which is genuinely one of my favorite games. Absolutely love playing that.
Same, yeah.
Yeah, and just added into BOB, which is already a fantastic framework. Wow. Super cool. I think one of the things that, you know, really makes me think is that this is a great game for onboarding new role-playing game players in general, because it sounds like it's quite approachable. And like, I think BOB does have this little bit of, it's not so much a stigma, but it's got a bit of a reputation for being, oh, it's very freeform, it's very open. And I think that can probably put some people off.
Yeah.
But I think what you've added to that is something that can make it so much more approachable, like by these really simple tweaks, which are actually really cool. Yeah, so major kudos to that. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I feel like I personally don't like systems that are too freeform, like not too open, the system matters kind of forms here, but I like having a lot of rules. I like having a lot of scaffolding. It's like a cozy little blanket I can wrap mm-hmm. myself with.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I love engaging with the mechanics of a game.
Yeah.
As much as possible. That's what I get enjoyment from,
mm-hmm.
which is, I guess, one reason that I like Blitz in the Dark or like Forge in the Dark games in general, because you are almost always engaging with the mechanics in some way or another. There's like very little, in my experience, like free-form role-playing.
Yeah, it often feels very guided, but yet super open at the same time. And that is, I think that's the sweet spot of structuring versus freeform. And I think for completely different reasons, Belonging Outside Belonging and Forged in the Dark games kind of have hit that sweet spot. And it's really interesting that your two games and, you know, supplements that are out at the moment are so focused on bringing new players into a particular, you know, style of play or style of system. And that's fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah,
I don't know what else to say. Yeah, I'm so interested.
I've always had fun playing Cantrip. I've always, you know, felt comfortable playing it, which is incredible, because I usually get incredibly anxious when I'm playing my own games with other people, because I cannot help, you know, being afraid of criticism or being judged.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like most designers must be familiar with this feeling. If anybody is not, please tell me your secrets.
Supreme confidence. That's the secret. Supreme and misplaced confidence. You have to have some of that fear, because otherwise you can't create. That's my opinion anyway. You're talking about here bringing new players into new games, kind of. Well, I'm sort of shoehorning you and railroading you into this conversation anyway. Does that fall out of your experience of bringing new players into games?
Oh, yeah, it does relate to my experience with that. I've had mostly a lot of success with teaching people new games and getting people to open up to new systems.
Fantastic. What's your secret?
I guess my secret is I'm very excited about the stuff that I like, and I can also be extremely pushy when I want to.
Supreme confidence strikes again. Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes you just gotta be pushy. One issue with like the local RPG scene is that people are simply not aware of games that aren't, you know, the most famous ones.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, Dungeons & Dragons is wildly popular here. But I also discovered that most countries have, like, their own extremely popular non-D&D games that sometimes even overshadows D&D.
Yeah.
In Japan, famously, everybody's playing Call of Cthulhu. Everybody loves playing COC in Japan. In Poland, I discovered recently that the most popular game for the longest time was Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay.
And like Germany, it's the Dark Eye. Nephilim was quite big in France.
Yeah.
You know, all these countries and Portugal and Brazil as well have a role-playing game, which name I've completely forgotten, but we're speaking to somebody from Brazil in a couple of weeks. I think it's really interesting to hear that in Argentina, perhaps the biggest game is Dungeons & Dragons. That's fascinating to me.
While the biggest game is probably Dungeons & Dragons, you would be surprised at how popular Vampire the Masquerade is here.
Ah, it's another big popular one. Yeah, yeah.
Huge.
That's interesting as well. Yeah. Is that a game that you've been into in the past? Or
yes, I actually played a lot of VTM and Vampire Dark Ages, which I didn't like as much, way before I even read a single page of a Dungeons & Dragons book.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really cool.
Well, what I was getting at was that in my experience with teaching people new games, which I do pretty often, I'm part of this Argentinian Discord that's like the community for a podcast called Session Zero, which is run by some friends of mine. And we have games on the Discord very often. And I'm in kind of a forever GM role.
Somebody has to.
Yeah, especially because, you know, I'm always reading new systems and I get excited and I'm like, you know, let's play this, let's try this. I've gotten a lot of experience teaching people new games, so I feel like I've gotten a good handle on where people might usually stumble when either explaining or learning a new game, what's important to say and what isn't. And I think that this like knack for explaining and imparting this this kind of knowledge comes from also having a lot of experience with board games. Me and my partner, we play a lot of board games.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally feel like teaching a board game is difficult because, like, opposed to a role-playing game where you can just have a very vague handle on the actual mechanics and still have fun.
I think that's super interesting because I would kind of assume, like, I don't teach a lot of board games. I don't teach a lot of role-playing games either, but I would kind of assume it to be completely the opposite way around because it feels like that you have to kind of get people into the right mindset. But I kind of see where you're coming from, which is like all role-playing games kind of share a very similar base, which is you're having a conversation which is telling a story, mm-hmm. and there aren't that many games which massively deviate from that. Whereas board games are all completely different.
Yeah, exactly. And I have, let's say, developed my own style for teaching board games. I have this little like flowchart mm-hmm. in my mind where I always start by explaining what we're doing in this game and most importantly, like how to win. What's the victory condition? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, and when does the game stop? Like, how does it end and who wins and how?
Yeah.
Because once you know that, whenever you are in doubt, you can just ask yourself, you know, of my possible actions, which one do I think is going to bring me closer to a victory condition? It's not all that dissimilar to teaching a role-playing game.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with like the CATS framework.
Take us through it.
The CATS framework is something I became familiar with via, I believe, The Gauntlet, the RPG community, The Gauntlet.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Run by super cool bunch of people.
Yeah. Extremely cool bunch of people. They have games all the time. The Codex magazine is great. CATS stands for Concept, Aim, Tone, and Subject Matter. Let's say you're giving like a CATS talk about, let's say, Blades in the Dark, since you're familiar with that.
Let's say Cantrip,
yeah. So the concept is we are young, either like teenage or young adult, witches attending a magical school and getting in trouble.
Yeah.
The aim, I usually split this between our aim as characters and our aim as players. The aim as players is to collaboratively tell a story about witches to express big feelings and to like revel in how wonderful and surprising magic can be.
Cool.
And as characters, we want to have our own goals. We want to make friends. We want to have as much fun as possible in what is otherwise an academic setting.
Mm-hmm.
Or is ostensibly an academic setting.
I love it.
Yeah, so that's their goal, yeah. So then it's tone, which in this case, it's mostly cozy and kind of wholesome and very chill vibe. But there can also be very big feelings, as you know, as young people tend to have in ways that they can't really process or control.
Yes.
And there can be danger, there can be dramatics, but the danger can never be something like there's not going to be any body horror in country.
Uh-huh, yeah. No dungeons, no dragons, right.
Exactly, yeah. The stakes can be high, but every problem does have a solution and things do mm-hmm. eventually work out.
Oh, so cool.
And the subject matter is something that ties very easily into like safety tools. Because
yes.
you can say, well, the subject matter here is, you know, academia, big feelings, exploring the unknown, contact with powers beyond your understanding.
Fantastic. I mean, that's a really interesting framework for introducing games.
It is.
It does something that, you know, a lot of people don't do, which is, you know, they introduce system first and
right.
themes afterwards. And yeah, nobody likes that. Nobody wants that.
Yeah.
One thing that this reminds me of is, like, last year, not to name drop or anything, but I was speaking to James D'Amato and Jeff Stolmer as well. And they both run an awful lot of games and have to, you know, onboard players and their guests into a lot of different game tones. You know, they said, the easiest way to do this is just to condense the rules as much as possible and then build outwards if you need to. And that's a really interesting way of thinking about it for like a one shot or even a short campaign, is that you know, you don't need everything from the beginning. And I think you're kind of building tools that speak to a similar mood, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's one reason I find like PBTA games easier to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they're well designed, then the fiction first principle applies a lot.
Yeah.
Like I can comfortably tell people, like, you don't need to like be guessing at your chances.
Yeah.
It's not a dungeon delve. We're not like playing to win, which in a dungeon delve means, you know, killing the monsters and getting the loot.
Yeah.
We're playing to tell a story. We want, you know, fun, interesting things to happen. So don't worry about your chances or your stats or your dice. Just, you know, tell us what you want to do right now.
Yeah.
And then when you do that, sometimes that will trigger the mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And once people get into that mindset, I think that they are much more comfortable playing and have like understanding.
Yeah.
A little bit of what these, you know, indie story games are trying to do.
Absolutely. That sounds like a really good way to kind of bring people on board. And it's a framework and a process that you can apply to a lot of different systems, I think. And especially the kind of indie games in the story game tradition that are not maybe so driven by mechanics.
Yeah, exactly.
They say snobbily. You know, I think that's a really interesting way to kind of introduce people to the space. Good on you for doing that. Actually,
yeah,
that sounds
really
cool.
I like to think I'm creating, you know, new lifelong players, new people who will contribute to the scene.
Yeah.
Whether it's the global internet-based scene or maybe it's hopefully our local scene, which we are, you know, trying to grow all the time.
Yeah.
I mostly do it by helping out around this Discord, in which I'm a moderator there.
You know, big respect to you for standing up and doing something and trying to, you know, make a nascent community amongst role players on the ground rather than interacting with people from all over the world, which, you know, is rewarding for different reasons.
It is.
But it's cool to be able to sit around a table or, you know, speak to people in your own time zone as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and the language thing is huge. Like,
yeah, no
if
doubt.
If you're not proficient in English or even bilingual, that's a huge barrier to, you know, making it in any capacity in the global RPG scene.
Yeah.
Not everybody speaks English. Like, there's a lot more English speakers in Argentina than there are, you know, Americans who speak Spanish.
That's really interesting as well, because I spoke to somebody last year from Southeast Asia, and they said the tone of their games was very different, whether they played them in English or whether they played them in their native language, which I believe was Tagalog. Do you think that applies as well? Do you think playing games in Spanish or English, you know, do they have different feels?
They absolutely do have different feels, not just because, let's say, I'm confident in my English, but I'm obviously much more comfortable playing in my own language,
mm-hmm.
especially with people like who are like from my own country.
Yeah.
Because that means that we have this kind of shared language.
Yes.
Maybe in terms of references or like ways of speaking, like you can inflect with your character to indicate a certain archetypical person.
And oh, that's really interesting.
Much more difficult to do in English.
Yeah.
And it can also happen like the other way around, like going back to, let's say, Blades in the Dark. It's always easy and funny to, you know, talk like you're in a Guy Ritchie movie if you play Blades, and it's going to work. But there is no equivalent to that in Spanish necessarily, because...
Do you think?
Or at least in Argentina, we don't have like the equivalent to the kind of, you know, Cockney, Guy Ritchie criminal type.
That's really funny. Yeah, because like, you know, I've got that kind of accent cultural reference that's quite easy. Like if I played role-playing games with British people, we would know which accents to lean into to infer which character types, right? I wouldn't do Cockney because I would butcher it. And I don't know how people always make dwarves Scottish, which does annoy me. But you know, that's really interesting. I'm absolutely fascinated by that space of language and accent and dialect. That's so cool.
Yeah, I've always wanted to play a game with Matt from Soul Muppet, because he has this fake northern accent.
I can't actually remember where Matt's from. I spoke to him the other week.
I believe he is from the north, somewhere in the north.
Yes, somewhere in the north. It's not fake northern accent.
No, it's not fake northern accent, no.
Now we've roasted Matt live on air. Now, so you've told us all about Cantrip. You've told us all about Session Zero. Where are we in terms of where Cantrip's releases? I feel like I want to say it out.
Well, Cantrip has already been officially released in its digital version. You can get it at the Soul Muppet store. I'm also putting together an itch page for it, if that's more convenient for people.
Mm-hmm.
It will be available in print very soon.
Wonderful.
We are sending 3 of the 5 Latin Breakout games to the printer next week, I believe.
Fantastic.
So you'll be able to get physical copies of Cantrip My Game, of Wendy's Here There Be Monsters, and also Brave Zenith.
Absolutely fantastic, and I will repeatedly plug those games when I see them out as print, because I think they're going to be absolutely fantastic. Misha, would you like to tell us where we can find you on the internet?
You can mostly find me at mishapanarin.itch.io, which is where I upload my games. I'm on Twitter as @panarin_misha. For any kind of professional contacts, if you want to get me to edit, translate, or you know, write for any of your games, you can email me at mishapanarinrpg@gmail.com.
Fantastic. We'll make sure all of those are in the show description. Thank you very much for giving us all of that information.
No, thank you.
And I guess all that remains for me to say is, Misha, thank you very much for coming on Yes Indeed Pod, and I cannot wait to see Cantrip in print.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. I had a really great time with this interview. I hope you did as well.
I sure did. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Misha for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. Next time, we're talking to Diogo from Toca do Coruja, a Brazilian team working to translate indie games to make them accessible, linguistically and financially, to a Brazilian Portuguese-speaking audience. We talked about how language and translation can be both artistic and political, and this was a thought-provoking and fascinating interview that I can't wait to share with you. So tune in 2 weeks to find out more. This week's episode has been kindly sponsored by Anthropos Games, whose game Heterodoxy is out from June 2022. In Heterodoxy, your group plays as young witches who have been brought together by a mysterious heretic to combat the empire that exiled them. There is no GM, and the campaign progresses as you answer questions together about the history of the heretic and uncover pieces of your own past, all while battling powerful monsters that were once witches like yourselves. The game plays out over 13 rounds that switch between hearth scenes and dramatic ventures. In hearth scenes, your witches teach subversive knowledge to villagers, train together in magic, and build artifacts of power. Players will take turns hosting small roleplay moments that let you heal from previous battles, learn from your mistakes, and prep for upcoming forays. Each witch will participate in one or more of the shared moments each hearth. Ventures are combat encounters that pit you against agents of the Empire and powerful Chimera. These dramatic scenes give you opportunities to learn the truth about the heretic who brought you all together, and to address conflicts within your crew, because after all, when's a better time to air your personal issues than during life or death combat with the enemy? Heterodoxy asks you to create the world and the characters together as you play, and you will uncover together the nature of the Empire, the sins of the heretic, and the fates of your young witches. PDFs available from Anthropos Games in June, with print scenes published in July. This week, I'd like to thank some of my incredible Patreon supporters: Hesan Yongdi, Sam Armstrong, Beyond Cataclysm Games, Georgie Batts, Sam Lay, Jack Blair, and Peter Ike. Thank you all so much. We couldn't do what we do without you. And you. Yes, you can get a regular shout-out and joyful thanks too if you go to patreon.com/yesindeedpod and sign up today. You'll get access to our Discord server where we can hang out and chat, and even join monthly editing streams of the Yes Indeed Pod Book Club. Most of the money will go directly to creators rather than to me, so you'll be investing directly in the indie scene, helping you to make it a healthy and inclusive space for years to come. And if you can't commit regularly, you can always help out by rating and reviewing the show wherever you find your podcasts, or by donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at yesindeedpod, that's YesIndiedPod. I'd love dearly to hear from you. Lastly, music credits. All music is taken from Be Quiet by Yatza from the Free Music Archive, released under Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 International License. Thanks, Yatza! Until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.